Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin wins more national and international cheese awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
Food and travel. They go hand in hand. And chances are, if you're a fan of Heritage Radio Network, you love them both. Between April 10th and 24th, we have six incredible food and travel experiences up for auction at charitybuzz.com. Go on an underground food tour of New Orleans with a rocket scientist. Get your hands on VIP passes to Feast Portland, or enjoy a ranch-to-table experience in wine country. Four of the experiences include hotel stays at some of the most iconic properties across the country, including the newly reopened Hotel Claremont in Atlanta. Now's your chance to win the ultimate Bourbon and Beyond weekend in Lexington, or take in a Latin food tour of New York's outer boroughs. You'll eat, drink, explore, and relax, all while supporting Heritage Radio Network. Help us keep the lights on and the mics hot. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/auction and bid now.
Oh, yes, it is Monday. This is the Heritage Radio Network, and this program is called What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and we're going to talk about trade and tariffs today. My guest is Michael Stumo. He is the CEO of the Coalition for a Prosperous America. He works closely and regularly with congressional offices on both sides of the aisle to educate political, media, and business leaders on issues including trade imbalances, trade enforcement, tax reform, agricultural trade, manufacturing policies, and more. He has written on trade policy and tax and economics for The Hill, for Breitbart, The American Prospect, Global Trade Magazine, and others. Welcome to the show, Michael. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Katie. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, first, let's thank you. I appreciate that. And tell us, first of all, what is the Coalition for a Prosperous America?
We're a unique organization. We're a coalition of agriculture, manufacturing, and organized labor. We are cover the left to the right of the spectrum, from the Tea Party right to the labor union left. We've had Bernie supporters and Hillary and Trump supporters in our group, and we've been around for about 10 years. We're focused on the trade deficit, the offshoring of American industry and agriculture,
right,
and want to balance trade.
Okay, so let's talk about balancing trade. So the way that the Trump administration is proposing to balance trade at the moment is to develop some tariffs against China, which I'm wondering how you feel those are going to play out for your agricultural sector.
Sure. Well, the China tariffs are based on technology theft by China of our intellectual property.
Right.
They're not designed necessarily to balance trade with China, which is a big problem. They are nearly half of our trade deficit. So China has doesn't let companies sell there unless you move there. You can't move your facilities there unless you joint venture with a government-owned company.
Yep.
And then they take your technology, and you've got about 3 or 4 years of sales before your IP is out in the wild, and they basically marginalize you out of the market. So that's what the basis of those are. But as far as agriculture, to the extent we are a net exporter, like in soybeans, corn, and wheat.
Yeah.
So certainly we have seen, the markets drop in the short term. We saw that in the stock market, too. The stock market comes back based upon whether corporate earnings are, solid.
Yeah.
And so the short-term noise tends to go away. I'm hoping it'll go away with agriculture because when you have a fungible commodity like soybeans or corn, if someone sells more into one market than than someone else sells where they used to sell. So if China were to cut back, which they haven't, and Brazil filled it, then we would fill where Brazil did, because it's a global market with global supply and demand. It's not the bilateral noise usually doesn't govern.
But isn't China is our third largest trading partner, is what I read. And they also own a lot of debt from America. And so when we talk about, imposing first a $60 billion trade tariff, and then now even escalating to a $100 billion trade, and that includes tariffs on things like, the Chinese are retaliating with tariffs on things like beef and pork and soy that we sell a lot of to them. So doesn't this all mean that American agriculture is going to take a hit? I totally get that.
On the front line, and we've been urging the administration to get very aggressive about protecting our farmers.
Yeah.
The trade with China is very unbalanced. They sell $387 billion more to us than we do them.
Right.
And oddly enough, we're sort of a third world colony economic position to them, in that we have a $24 billion surplus in commodities, that's agriculture, mining, and energy, commodities to them. But they have a $400 billion surplus with us in manufactured goods, which is kind of like Britain's relationship with Africa, the subcontinent of India, and North America in the imperial days, where Britain would import the commodities, add value, and sell manufactured goods to everybody else. So that's not the kind of trade picture we want with China. That does not mean we don't want to be exporting our oversupply, but I'm hoping that the soy and corn markets come back to fundamentals, like how much global demand is there, how much global supply, and there's too much oversupply. For pork and beef, we're a net importer. The big problem there is allowing too much low-quality imports from countries like Mexico and Brazil.
Yeah. Particularly Brazil. I mean, they've had a lot of scandal recently, both with tainted food, tainted beef, and with their, with the whole JBS, the Baptista family, all going basically to jail, apparently, for racketeering and
look up Operation Car Wash, and you'll see the biggest corruption investigation in history, which JBS is a part of.
Ah.
And as of today, it was announced that another Brazilian meatpacking firm, Marfrig, is buying National Beef.
Yes, saw that.
JBS is the biggest beef processor in the world. Marfrig will be number two, and they control our markets.
Whoa. I didn't realize that Marfrig was that, National. First of all, why is that happening? Why wouldn't that be the subject of an antitrust suit, to have an American company be acquired by a Brazilian company? I mean, I don't know why they didn't stop the Smithfield sale. I don't know why they didn't stop JBS from acquiring, say, Pilgrim's Pride. And I forget what other big beef packer they absorbed, but they did that too. And this was sort of like, I don't know, that was in the 90s, I guess. But why do you think antitrust legislation is not brought to bear, or at least scrutiny is not brought to bear on these big acquisitions?
Well, that used to be my my bailiwick. Antitrust. I helped litigate a case against Tyson in 2004 for price fixing in cattle. And over an eight-year period, we won at the jury trial level in Alabama and got a $1.8 billion verdict, but the appellate court overruled it. You also missed one, a big one. The Chinese bought Smithfield Foods.
Yeah, I said that. Yeah. No, I did say that.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's what got me interested in that part of, sort of the whole, monopolization and concentration of the meat industry, about which I should tell you that I wrote a book. So I am not a completely, a tyro when it comes to this stuff. But, I've just been very curious about sort of, and very concerned from a food security aspect of what the implications are down the road of, it's the same thing as letting Monsanto and Bayer merge. You know what I mean? When you have other, or even worse, Syngenta and ChemChina, where you have two foreign companies that are then, developing technology that has an impact on American agriculture.
Right.
I mean, I find these all very worrying.
The question is whether they have enough market power to adversely affect the market and consumers. Mm-hmm. The problem with antitrust is there's so much focus on protecting consumers that in the case of agribusiness, where the harm is to the farmers and the ranchers, they're not consumers. So the judges are trying to ignore harm to farmers and ranchers because they focus on consumer harm. whether a foreign company or a domestic company owns, you know, a business here, antitrust is agnostic on that, unfortunately. But we do have the committee, we do have some regulation of foreign investment here by something called the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., which is some legislation to strengthen. But that's just on national security grounds. It's not on antitrust grounds. And it's unfortunately not on economic security grounds. So, so far, it's been hard to stop China buying Smithfield, for example.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that got some pushback, but not as nowhere near as much as I would have put. I mean, they own one in four hogs in the United States. I consider that really unfortunate, because that one in four hogs means they're eating that much American corn and soy and drinking that much American water and polluting that much American, you know, soil and streams. So,
right, and now they control the National Pork Producers Council, which is the top pork lobbyist in the country, so it's infiltration at the political level, too.
Right, right. Oh, this is so interesting, Michael. You're not at all what I thought you would be like. So let's go back to the tariffs for a second. So I think you mentioned the fact that we're trying to protect you know, intellectual property. And I certainly think that most Americans would agree that that was a desirable goal. But are tariffs the only way to do that? I mean, I don't. I feel like these tariffs are going to blow up in the agricultural sector's face, and we're not going to be that much farther ahead on the intellectual property issues. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I think the intellectual property, I think it is pretty effective. Now, this is what happens. Virtually everything you read in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, you know, NPR, whatever news media is wrong. This trade war stuff is going to stop trade. It's going to cause a recession. Tariffs just shift the composition of trade. So if we put a tariff against steel or, you know, certain intellectual property-based products coming in, our balance of trade is not likely to change. Trade will flow around. It will change the composition of trade. It can be effective. The overall strategy, if I were king and would help hope the Trump administration gets there, would be to have a comprehensive strategy on tariffs, to fix cheating and to design your trade and production composition to optimize that. Exchange rate management to neutralize other countries' undervaluation, which causes trade imbalances. When the other countries have weak currencies, we have a trade deficit with them because everything they sell us is too cheap and everything we sell them is too expensive.
Yeah.
And lastly, an industrial policy, which we already have in, you know, tax cuts for certain places or different programs and the like, but we don't coordinate it. China coordinates it. Germany coordinates it. So we need an ag and an industrial policy to support the type of industries we want. That's the full boat. So with tariffs, we think it's got to be a part of it. We think we've got to get through this. We think the administration needs to bring the full force of the government to protect our farmers and ranchers, but can't back down, because that's part of the whole package for us to have an economy in 20 years.
Well, okay, so I noticed that quite a lot of Republicans suggest that they're kind of alarmed about the potential consequences for American agriculture if these tariffs go forward. Why are they concerned, but you're not? I mean, why don't you see the same thing that they see, or why don't they see the same thing that you see? I would think they'd be on the same page with you, I guess is my point.
Well, yeah, first, you know, the GOP and some of the Democrats have said trade's going to save us. We're going to pass all these trade agreements, NAFTA, CORUS, the Korea trade agreement, this and that. We have more trade agreements than we have ever had in world history, in U.S. history. And farmers were doing horribly, including my father in Iowa, before these actions. So that didn't work, right? Trade saving agriculture did not work. We ended up in a very bad place. Number one. Number two, the domestic programs that we used to have before the 1996 Farm Bill worked pretty well, but the WTO membership forced us not to have those farm programs because they violated new international trade law. The WTO is a huge problem for us to get a policy to fix agriculture and get them a basic, you know, kind of a price that they used to have before they were failing. With this, I do share, and I mentioned before, I share concerns that this short-term noise won't resolve based upon global supply and demand fundamentals, which they often do, and that Trump did order the USDA secretary to use his expansive authority to protect farmers and ranchers,
Right.
We want them to do that, but it's we don't know what they're planning to do.
Oh,
but,
yeah, because that was going to be my question. Like, what, you know, is this going to be separate and outside of the farm bill, or is it going to be negotiated into the farm bill as something that will support prices or otherwise, you know, extend some relief to the sectors that are most affected by retaliatory tariffs, you know, such as, I mean, not that I think the soybean industry has a lot of it's going to suffer too much. But I do know that the smaller guys producing beef and pork who rely heavily on those commodity prices and those feedstocks are definitely wetting their pants in many cases over these proposed tariffs. I mean, I can't imagine what the Trump administration or even Sonny Perdue. Do you have any sense of what he's thinking about this, or is that just still a blank slate?
The USDA, Sonny Perdue, he's sort of the old style, you know, GOP. And look, I've got plenty of blame to go around for Democrats and Republicans because Clinton, Bush, and Obama, you know, screwed us up with this trade, you know, naive free trade. Free trade doesn't exist. It's like a pink unicorn. It's fun to talk about, but you never see one.
Huh.
And
that's an interesting statement, Michael. That's a very strong statement because you're saying, so you favor a kind of protectionist model? Is that what you're saying?
Look, the reason that we are the biggest net importer in the world and absorb other industrial countries' overcapacity is because we're naive free traders. They talk free trade. They don't practice it. They have a scenario of exchange rate management to keep their currencies low. Germany, Korea, Japan, Taiwan, China. They have industrial policy. Korea supposedly has free trade agreement with us. Try finding a Ford or a Chevy on their streets. Mm. They're closer to Japan. Try to find a Honda or a Toyota in Seoul. They just don't do that. They were Korea first before we were America first. They're all protectionist, mercantilist countries protecting their jobs and their industries, and they should, and so should we. Free trade doesn't work. It doesn't exist.
I'm digesting that.
Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds, delicious, fresh and squeaky cheese curds, or deep fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the Farmstead Cheese Company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious Stinky Limburger and its long storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Satori's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk. Fourth generation cheesemakers combine old world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
Would I be correct in assuming that you also do not favor the kinds of, for instance, regulations that have protected, say, Canadian dairy farmers, you know, from overproduction and failing prices? Would that also come under the same, rubric of protectionism? Like, I know it's a different aspect, but still, like, don't we need to have those kinds of protections as well?
Yeah, so with Canada, for us, they should have, that's their industrial policy, apply to agriculture,
right,
to keep Canadian farmers from going broke. They should have the right to do it, and trade agreements shouldn't prevent them from doing it. But we should not pretend that, you know, just dropping tariffs is going to fix us, because some of those Canadian programs have bleed over or spillover effects into our market. We've dismantled our programs, the effective parts for our dairy producers, and you know, these trade deals are sort of an international libertarian deregulation agenda where nobody can do what they used to do to protect their industries. We should just get better at the right way that fits our country to assist our industries in being successful and to keep the to reverse the impoverishing of rural communities that are turning into, you know, places where food stamps and meth labs and the like. It's right. The new ghetto.
So what are those? It. What is that right way? What is the right way? If it isn't extending trade around the world, you know, globalization, then you're saying that it's really more about protecting or re-regulating our own markets. What would work, do you think, to fix the rural economies of this country?
Yeah. Well, the big thing that we should do is fix our exchange rate. The dollar is overvalued because it used to be China and Japan and other country central banks bought dollars very heavily, sold their own currencies, so it drove their currencies low, drove the dollar high, making everything farmers and ranchers and manufacturers sell too expensive on global markets and making all the imports too cheap. Uh-huh. Courtesy of their central banks. Nobody's talking about exchange rates, but you'll see something in the next couple of weeks. Trump did talk about China currency manipulation. He sort of dropped it. They should get back onto it. But the fact is, the dollar is about 20% overvalued, and we need to slowly move the dollar down to a trade balancing equilibrium price that would balance our $500 billion trade deficit of 2017 within 2 years, and you would see much more massive ag sales from our markets, including soybeans and pork and beef, than you've ever seen. Exchange rates are the big way to go, and then to talk about a domestic policy strategy.
But then I read that currency manipulation, which was a big thing a few years ago from the Chinese, they've stopped doing that, apparently. And that's no longer evident. I mean, from what I've read, that's not really a factor at this point.
Yeah, it's largely ebbed, and that's right. And the thing is, we cannot exonerate private capital. So private capital is coming in from foreign countries and weaponizing our dollar. In other words, there's excessive, massive inflows of private capital coming in, buying dollar assets, driving our exchange rate or our dollar price too high. There's various reasons for interest rates. We're a safe haven for parking wealth.
Yeah.
We're world's reserve currency, things like that. But our interest is, so when that happens, anyone who's selling dollar assets sells them higher, so like Wall Street or Treasury bonds, but all goods and services are too expensive on global markets.
Uh-huh.
So Germany and China grew off of low-priced currency. We are stagnating with a high-priced currency. And exchange rates in the intellectual laboratory or textbooks are always supposed to be at or near their trade balancing price.
Right.
We are far above it, so we want to reconnect the dollar with a trade balancing dollar price.
That seems very reasonable. I mean, not that I understand really a single thing you just said. No.
That's why the Trump tariffs are good for the composition of trade, except for, you know, the farm risk, which I talked about doing. But the trade people don't get the fact that exchange rates are the big kahuna here.
Right, right. Well, I can see it does make sense to me that would be sort of the elephant in the room that no one is talking about. And so that would be, but that would require some sort of regulation on Wall Street. And is that what you're saying? Is that what,
well,
the direction
the way,
you're
what
pointing
in? Well, what we favor, and if, you know, we've got a couple studies on our website, we favor something called capital flow control, something that controls the flow of capital into your country, which is putting a small variable rate charge on incoming capital to moderate it. It's like a peak load charge. Say you've got too much traffic on New York City streets at rush hour, you put a peak load for cars coming in to... not to stop cars, but to moderate it, to pull them, the volume of them back.
Or
when you've got a summer day, a hot summer day, and too many air conditioners are going, you got a peak load charge on electricity to keep people from consuming too much. Not to stop electricity, you go back to the dark ages, just moderate it.
Sure.
And you do that when there's a peak load or too much excessive demand for the dollar, driving it up so our whole economy is non-competitive. You start with something like 0.5% on incoming flows and the like, and you move it up or down accordingly. We'd like, we're preparing some legislation we think is going to be introduced in the next month. We're hoping the administration will, you know, be supportive or at least not try to block it, but just to moderate the excessive foreign flows coming in that bid the dollar too high and make soybeans 20% too expensive on world markets, even at their current price, just because of the dollar price.
But then if the price of soybeans comes down, for example, then, I mean, I don't follow what soybeans cost in the world exchanges or even on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. But it seems to me if those prices come down, then those farmers, not that I feel a lot of sympathy for mega ag, but those farmers take a big economic hit there, don't they?
No, if you have a, you know, we have, if you have $10 soybeans, $10 a bushel,
yeah,
you're a foreign buyer. When you're a foreign buyer, you're buying foreign. The first question you ask isn't what is the cost of the item. Your first question is what's the exchange rate.
I see.
Then you go to the cost in the domestic, you know, currency from where you're buying.
Uh-huh.
So if we have $10 beans and you have the dollar devalue, let's say by 20%, that's $2. You just made the beans the equivalent of $8 beans
cheaper
for foreign buyers, even though the farmer still gets, you know, $10 here.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. That seems reasonable. I am literally such a, you know, so ignorant about how economics works that it's amazing I could even come up with the outline for this show. But I really did want to get some expert opinions on this stuff because, you know, everything you read in the papers and even in the ag journals, which I follow. I mean, I read Drover's Daily. I read Meeting Place. I mean, I pay attention to this stuff. And, for example, what's his name? Chip Flory or something who writes not AgriPulse, but one of the other, you know, for Drovers, and he writes for the Farm Journal. He said that he's very worried about these tariffs and how they're going to, you know, affect, you know, people in the meat sector for certain. And then I was wondering, you know, so, and you're saying that's not necessarily going to happen. And of course, lower inputs for their cattle and pork would be very welcome, I've no doubt, because they have to compete with ethanol for those very same products, right? So that has an impact on those prices as well.
Right. To the extent we're a net importer, you know, with hogs and cattle, that's our big problem, is letting in too many imports. To the extent we're a massive net exporter in proportion to our production, which is in the row crops, that is, you know, the worry. And I share the worry. I think we may see that it's just noise because you get the markets going, but you've got global demand and global supply.
Yeah.
And you've got a fungible commodity with all those suppliers dumping into it, and as people demand it. And the mere fact that it shifts, that it may shift around if China changes or somebody else does,
yeah,
does not change the fact there's global supply. There's people that want it. So you're shifting, you're diverting trade, but you're not necessarily changing the fundamentals of the market.
Right.
That's certainly the true with tariffs in many other cases.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, you know, we don't know. Markets are not rational. They're irrational.
Yeah.
The stock markets have shown that there's noise, that they come back based on earnings. The ag market should and often do. Whether they will, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's very scary. And in our last minute here, because I know you have to go, what are your hopes for NAFTA? Because again, you know, many farmers are terribly alarmed that they're going to miss out on their big trading partners, Mexico and Canada, and that will not have the same markets open to them. And that seems to be a very legitimate concern. How do you respond to that?
Sure. We're not a big net exporter to Canada, so it doesn't matter that much. We are more to Mexico and What tends to happen is whatever the U.S. price is, everyone else, other countries, undercut it by a certain margin. So
yeah.
I don't think it'll have much of an issue. We are very close for transportation purposes. So if they want to try shipping from Ukraine, good luck with that.
Mm-hmm.
NAFTA's kind of been a disaster, but not necessarily for agriculture, although it has for beef and for fruits and vegetables.
Yeah.
So it's differential impact. I think, frankly, farmers are going to be fine from NAFTA. I think the president is going to do something that doesn't harm them, unlike the China potential. But I can't say that for sure. But I do like where Trump is going generally.
Interesting. You might be one of the few people in the world, Michael, that shares that feeling. But clearly you speak from a position of education that most of the rest of us do not possess. I know you need to go now, so I will thank you so much. If people want to learn more about what you're doing over there at the Coalition for a Prosperous America, where can they find that information?
Prosperousamerica.org.
Okay, that's great. Thank you so much, Michael, for joining me today. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Katie.
Yep. We'll talk again, I hope. Bye-bye.
All right. Great. Take care.
Thank you. And thanks to my sponsor, Wisconsin Cheese. I appreciate their support of this radio station. And thanks to my listeners, as always, for listening. And, of course, to the incredible Dave. I'm going to get that one of these days. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll see you next week. We'll be right back.
for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.